A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel sent us. He and Hannah are in the middle of a move right now, in peak Israeli summer, with a six-month-old. Their roof developed a leak. The landlord refused to fix it. After 2 weeks of waiting, Daniel asked for a repair timeline, and the landlord responded by terminating their lease. Legally, it's not called an eviction, but functionally, they're being forced out of their home because they asked for a roof that doesn't leak. And this is the part Daniel really wants us to dig into. He's someone who prepares for everything, who anticipates crises before they arrive, and yet here he is, physically broken, financially drained, and finding himself almost unable to say the words, "This is too much." He's asking what it takes to give yourself permission to admit you're past your limits, and then what help you can actually cobble together when the system offers none.
That lease termination detail is the thing that sticks with me. You ask your landlord to fix a leak, not sue him, not withhold rent, just ask for a timeline, and his answer is to throw you out. And the law looks at that and says, well, it's not technically an eviction, so nothing to see here. That's not a loophole, that's the design.
It's July. Every family in this country who needs to move is trying to do it right now, which means the agent fees are non-negotiable, even though they're technically illegal. The moving companies are booked solid, and landlords know they can afford to be callous because someone else will take the apartment tomorrow.
The agent fee situation is genuinely Kafkaesque. The government explicitly outlawed charging tenants a fee of 1 month's rent plus VAT. So the industry just restructured who pays whom, and now it's effectively mandatory again. You can't rent without paying it, and you can't report it because everyone's complicit. It's an illegal fee that every single renter pays.
That's before you even get to the security deposit Daniel's landlord is probably going to fight him over, or the 10,000 shekels their last move cost, or the week he spent hauling boxes himself to save money, while also working and caring for an infant.
The surface-level story is a brutal move during a brutal season in a brutal market. But what Daniel's actually asking about is the psychological mechanism underneath it. He's a preparer. That's his identity. He plans for contingencies. And the irony he's naming is that the more you prepare, the more overconfident you become that your preparations are adequate. Then when the roof leaks and the landlord retaliates, the failure doesn't just hurt materially. It feels like a personal moral failing. Like you should have seen it coming.
Because if you just prepared better, right?
And that's the trap.
It's a trap with a name, actually. Kahneman and Tversky called it the planning fallacy. People systematically underestimate how long things will take, how much they'll cost, and how many things can go wrong. And here's the cruel twist. The more you prepare, the worse the bias gets. You build this mental model of the move based on the last one, and that 10,000 shekel figure becomes an anchor. You think you know the territory.
Right, because you've done it before. You've got receipts. You know what the movers charge, you know the agent fee is coming, you've budgeted for it. So when Daniel spent that week hauling boxes himself, he wasn't just saving money. He was reinforcing the belief that effort equals control. Ellen Langer at Harvard called this the illusion of control. You put in the work, you make the plan, and your brain quietly upgrades, "I've prepared to, I've got this handled."
Then the roof leaks.
The roof leaks, and the landlord doesn't just refuse to fix it, he terminates the lease. That's not a cost overrun. That's not something you budget for. That's what Donald Rumsfeld would call an unknown. Unknown. And I hate that I just quoted Donald Rumsfeld.
I'm going to let that sit there. But the point holds. Daniel's preparation wasn't flawed. It was rational. He anticipated the known costs. He tried to minimize them. What he couldn't anticipate was the landlord using the lease as a weapon. And when that happened, the failure didn't register as "the system failed me." It registered as "I should have been more prepared."
That's the identity piece. Daniel describes himself as a survivor, someone who doesn't admit failure. And that identity is useful. It's probably gotten him through a lot. But identities have shadow costs. When your sense of self is built on handling things, admitting you're over your head isn't just a practical concession. It feels like you're surrendering who you are.
I think that's what this episode is really about. Not just moving tips or landlord horror stories. It's about the gap between the myth of self-reliance and the reality of a system that's designed to extract from you. The psychology that makes it hard to ask for help, and the practical question of what help even exists when you finally do.
The arc I'm seeing is this. First, we need to dig into why this happens. The cognitive biases that turn preparation into overconfidence and failure into shame. Then we look at the system Daniel's actually up against. Because the Israeli rental market isn't just tough, it's structured in ways that most tenants don't understand until they're bleeding. And then, crucially, we get to the framework. When you're physically broken and financially drained, what do you actually do? What resources exist, however threadbare, and how do you give yourself permission to use them?
Because the alternative, the thing Daniel's fighting against, is just grinding forward alone until something breaks. And with a 6-month-old in the house, something breaking isn't abstract.
Let's start with the planning fallacy, because it's doing something specific here that's worse than the textbook version. Kahneman and Tversky's original insight was that people anchor on their best-case scenario and then adjust insufficiently. But Daniel's case is almost the inverse. He anchored on his worst-case scenario, 10,000 shekels. That's a real number from a real move, and he budgeted for it probably with some padding.
Which should have worked,
and that's what makes the psychological fallout so much sharper. When you anchor on a concrete past experience, your brain treats it as the ceiling of what can go wrong. You've already done the hard version. How much worse could it get? And then the landlord terminates the lease, and suddenly you're not just paying for movers, you're paying for movers on short notice in July when every moving company in the country is booked. You're not just paying an agent fee, you're paying it while also losing days of work to viewings you didn't plan for.
The anchor becomes a trap. The 10,000 shekels wasn't a floor. It was a false summit.
That's exactly the phrase. And the research on this is brutal. The planning fallacy doesn't just make you underestimate. It makes you overconfident in proportion to how much effort you've invested. The more detailed your spreadsheet, the more certain you are that the spreadsheet covers reality. Daniel spent a week moving boxes himself. That's not just labor, that's psychological commitment. Every box he carried was a deposit into the I've got this account.
Which brings us to Langer's illusion of control. You're a retired pediatrician. You've probably seen this in clinical settings.
All the time. Parents of chronically ill children, for example. The ones who kept the most meticulous symptom journals were often the most devastated when a new complication arose, because the journaling had created this unspoken belief that vigilance could prevent bad outcomes. Langer's experiments were simpler. She had people roll dice and found that they threw harder when they wanted high numbers, but the mechanism scales. Effort masquerades as influence.
Daniel's week of hauling boxes wasn't just cost-cutting. It was a ritual.
A ritual that said, I am in control of this move. And then the landlord says, actually, you're not even in control of whether you have a home next month. That's not a setback. That's the illusion shattering. And the psychological injury isn't proportional to the material loss. It's proportional to the gap between what you believed you controlled and what you actually controlled.
Which was almost nothing, it turns out.
The agent fee was never negotiable. The landlord's good faith was never guaranteed. The security deposit was never secure. The roof was never within his power to fix. But the preparation made all of those things feel manageable because preparing feels like doing, and doing feels like controlling.
Then there's the third layer, which might be the hardest to talk about. Daniel names it himself, the survivor identity, strong instincts to not admit failure, keep moving forward, and I recognize that. I think a lot of people listening will recognize it.
It's masculine-coded stoicism, but it's also professional competence. If you're someone whose career is built on solving problems, on anticipating edge cases, on being the person who has the answer, then being flattened by a leaky roof and a callous landlord doesn't just hurt. It's embarrassing.
That's the word. The material cost is 10,000 shekels, plus the agent fee, plus lost work, plus the security deposit you might never see. But the identity cost is that you have to look at yourself and say, I couldn't handle this. And for someone like Daniel, that feels more expensive than the money.
Here's where the trade-off gets tricky, because Daniel's reluctance to ask for help isn't irrational. It's not just pride. He's operating in a system that offers very little help. So the instinct to just push through isn't delusional. It's a rational adaptation to an environment where the safety net isn't there. The problem is that rational adaptations can become self-defeating when the situation escalates past a certain point.
That's the line, isn't it? The point where self-reliance stops being a strategy and starts being a punishment.
You can measure that line. Daniel gave us the metrics himself, financially not far behind. A 6-month-old whose parents are too exhausted to be present. When you hit that intersection, physical depletion, financial precarity, caregiving strain, the cost of not asking for help has already exceeded the cost of asking. The math has flipped, but the psychology hasn't caught up.
Because the psychology is still running on the old identity. I'm the one who handles things. I don't call my family for money. I don't admit I'm drowning.
If I can put my old pediatrician hat on for a moment, this is where parental burnout research gets relevant. Chronic stress of this kind, the kind where you're just surviving day to day with no end in sight, it doesn't just exhaust you. It degrades the quality of your attention, your patience, your ability to read your child's cues. A 6-month-old doesn't know you're moving. They just know you're not there.
That's the real cost of the survivor identity. When it overstays its welcome, it protects your dignity at the expense of your family's well-being.
Dignity is a real thing worth protecting. I'm not dismissing it. But there's a difference between protecting your dignity and protecting an image of yourself that no longer matches reality. The image says, I can handle this alone. The reality is a leaky roof, a retaliatory landlord, an illegal agent fee, and a baby who needs parents who aren't shattered.
The question Daniel's really asking isn't, how do I fix the move? It's how do I let go of the person I thought I was, long enough to survive the person the situation is forcing me to become.
Which is someone who needs help, and the permission to be that person, that's what we need to build toward. But permission is only half of it. The other half is what you're giving yourself permission to access. And that's where we need to look at the system Daniel's actually up against, because the Israeli rental market isn't just difficult. It's structured to extract from tenants in ways that most people don't fully see until they're bleeding.
Walk me through it. If I'm a renter in Israel right now, what am I actually protected by?
And I don't say that hyperbolically. There's no national rent control, no just cause eviction requirement once your initial lease term ends. If you're month to month after the first year, which most tenants are, the landlord can terminate with 30 days notice for essentially any reason, or no reason. Daniel asked for a repair timeline. The landlord didn't have to justify the termination. It's legal.
The distinction Daniel made, legally not an eviction, functionally identical, that's the entire system in one sentence.
The agent fee situation is almost a perfect metaphor for how the system actually works versus how it's supposed to work. The law says tenants don't pay agent fees. The reality is every tenant pays 1 month's rent plus VOT, and the industry just rerouted the payment through a technicality. The government knows this. Everyone knows this.
Because the people who'd need to enforce it are the same people who'd need to rent an apartment next year.
It's a collective action problem where the cost of being the one person who refuses to pay is homelessness. So the fee persists, and it's not small. On a 5,000 shekel monthly rent, you're looking at 5,000 plus 17% VAT, nearly 6,000 shekels just to get the keys. That's before the security deposit, before the movers, before you've bought a single box.
That's the known cost. That's what Daniel budgeted for. The leak was the unknown that made all the knowns irrelevant.
Right? And here's where the knock-on effect kicks in. The system doesn't just fail to protect tenants. It actively punishes the ones who try to assert the few rights they have. Daniel asked for a repair. The landlord retaliated. If Daniel now fights the security deposit, he's looking at months of dispute, probably in small claims court, while also trying to work and parent and recover from the move itself.
The rational move in the system is to absorb the cost and stay quiet, which is exactly what the system is designed to produce.
Design might be too intentional, but the effect is the same. Tenants learn that asserting rights is more expensive than eating the loss, and that learned helplessness becomes the norm.
Which brings us to the safety net, or the lack of one. Daniel mentioned it. He doesn't think Israel has much help to offer people like him. Is he right?
He's right, and I want to be precise about why. The Ministry of Construction and Housing does offer rental subsidies, but they're means-tested, and the thresholds target low-income families. If you're a professional couple earning a middle-class income, you're almost certainly disqualified, even if you've just been hit with an unexpected move that strained your savings. The system doesn't ask, did you just lose 10,000 shekels to a retaliatory landlord? It asks, what was your income last year?
The safety net is designed for chronic poverty, not acute crisis.
And that distinction matters because it means a family can be financially stable on paper and absolutely drowning in practice, and the state looks at them and says, you're fine. Daniel and Hannah are professionals. They have jobs. On a spreadsheet, they don't look like they need help. But the spreadsheet doesn't see the six-month-old, the lost work days, the agent fee they had to pay again, the security deposit they might not get back.
Or the week of hauling boxes that Daniel's body is still recovering from.
And that physical depletion isn't just discomfort, it compounds into the parenting. This is the third piece I want to sit with for a moment, because it's the one that makes me most concerned as a pediatrician. Daniel has a six-month-old son. At 6 months, babies are developing attachment patterns. They're learning whether their caregivers are reliably present and responsive. When parents are chronically stressed, physically exhausted, and emotionally drained, that responsiveness degrades. Not because they don't love their child, because they're running on empty.
The research backs this up.
Parental burnout studies show that chronic stress, the kind without a clear endpoint, produces emotional distancing, reduced patience, and what researchers call a sense of inefficacy, the feeling that nothing you do matters. For a six-month-old, the parent is the entire world. If the parent is shattered, the world feels unstable.
The cost of not asking for help isn't just financial or physical, it's developmental.
I don't want to overstate it. Children are resilient, and a few weeks of stressed parents during a move isn't going to cause permanent damage. But the pattern matters. If Daniel keeps grinding forward alone, if this becomes the default response to crisis, that accumulates.
Let's talk about what actually exists. You've painted a picture of a system that extracts, a safety net that excludes, and a psychological trap that makes asking for help feel like failure. If someone's listening and they're in Daniel's position right now, what can they actually do?
There are a few threads, and none of them are sufficient on their own, but together they're better than nothing. First, tenant advocacy. The Israel Consumer Council, you can reach them at *6603, they do mediate disputes between tenants and landlords, including security deposit fights. I know of a family in Tel Aviv who used them after a landlord withheld their deposit over claim damages that predated their tenancy. It took 6 months, but they recovered about 70%.
6 months is a long time when you need the money now.
But 70% of something is better than 100% of nothing, and the alternative, just walking away, guarantees zero. The council doesn't charge for mediation, so the only cost is patience.
If the landlord is actively litigious, like Daniel seems to be.
That's where the university legal aid clinics come in. Tel Aviv University's Law Clinic, Hebrew University, several others. They offer free legal advice on tenant disputes. Law students supervised by faculty handle cases. It's not a law firm, but for a security deposit dispute or understanding your rights when a lease is terminated, it's real help at no cost. Daniel's landlord has expressly forbidden repairs on the property they're leaving. That's a red flag that the deposit fight is coming. Getting legal advice now, before the landlord makes the first move, is smart.
Then there's the family piece. Daniel mentioned borrowing from family as an option, but you can hear the reluctance in how he framed it.
I understand that reluctance. Family loans carry emotional weight that bank loans don't. There's shame, there's obligation, there's the fear that the relationship changes. But here's the reframe I'd offer. In a system that's designed to extract from you, borrowing from family isn't a failure of self-reliance. It's using the one safety net that the system can't take away. Frame it as a short-term loan with clear terms. Write it down, treat it seriously, but don't treat it as a moral failing.
Because the alternative is credit card debt at Israeli interest rates, or worse.
Or just not recovering, physically, financially, emotionally. And the cost of that, to Daniel, to Hannah, to Ezra, is far higher than the discomfort of asking family for help.
One thing that strikes me, comparing Israel to other places. In Germany, Daniel's situation wouldn't have happened. A landlord in Berlin can't terminate a lease without what they call legitimate interest. Personal use, major renovation, something concrete. a leaky roof that the landlord refuses to fix. The tenant would have legal recourse, and rent increases are capped. The power dynamic is fundamentally different.
The U.S. varies wildly by state, but Israel is closer to the landlord-friendly end of that spectrum, with the added burden of the agent fee that most American renters don't pay. The comparison isn't meant to make anyone feel worse. It's to name the reality. If you're struggling in this system, it's not because you're bad at preparing. It's because the system is not designed to protect you.
What do you actually do when you're in this position? Let me give you a framework, because Daniel asked for it directly. Am I physically exhausted? Am I financially at a breaking point? Is my family suffering? If the answer to any of those is yes, the math has already flipped. The cost of not asking for help now exceeds the cost of asking.
The framework matters because it externalizes the decision. You're not standing in the wreckage trying to intuit whether you've suffered enough to deserve help. You're checking boxes. It's mechanical. That's intentional. It bypasses the identity machinery that tells you to keep grinding.
Right. Because the identity machinery is the problem. It's not that Daniel doesn't know he's exhausted. He told us he's physically broken. But knowing and giving yourself permission are different things. The checklist bridges that gap.
Once you've answered yes, the next step is concrete. Photos of the leak. Screenshots of every email and WhatsApp exchange with the landlord. Receipts for the movers, the agent fee, every shekel this has cost. If the security deposit fight comes, and it sounds like it's coming, you want a paper trail that makes the landlord's position untenable before you even walk into a dispute.
Daniel's landlord expressly forbade repairs. That's an email, or it should be. That's evidence that the landlord prevented him from mitigating damages, which a small claims judge is going to find interesting.
Small claims is the next piece. In Israel, the maximum claim is 34,000 shekels, and you don't need a lawyer. You file the paperwork yourself. It's not fast, but is designed to be accessible. For a security deposit that's being withheld in bad faith, this is the exact mechanism that exists. Most landlords count on tenants being too exhausted to use it.
Which is the extraction model again. The system bets you won't fight back.
The countermove is to fight back precisely because you've already documented everything. The Israel Consumer Council, star 6603, can mediate before it even gets to court. The landlord might still refuse, but now you've established a record of trying to resolve it reasonably, which a judge will also notice.
Then there's the family piece, which I know is the hardest one for Daniel to hear. He mentioned borrowing from family almost as a last resort, something he'd rather not do.
I want to say this carefully because the reluctance is real and I respect it. But Daniel, if you're listening, the 10,000 shekels is a sunk cost. It's gone. The financial stress you're feeling right now isn't going to be solved by grinding harder. It's going to be solved by bridging the gap, and family is the bridge that doesn't charge interest. Frame it as a short-term loan with clear terms. Write it down. Pay it back. But don't let shame about asking turn a temporary cash flow problem into a long-term debt spiral.
The shame of asking is temporary. The relief is lasting. And I think that's the line Daniel needs to hear, because he's been running on the assumption that the shame of asking is permanent, that it rewrites who he is.
It does it. It rewrites the situation. And for listeners who aren't Daniel but are in something similar, the first step is the smallest and the hardest. Name it out loud. Say, this is too much. Not to yourself in your head at 3 a.m. Your spouse, a friend, a family member. Then make one call. The Consumer Council. A legal aid clinic. Just one call. The paralysis breaks when the first action happens.
After all that, there's a bigger question we need to ask. What would it actually take to build a real safety net for middle-class families in Israel? Because Daniel's story isn't an anomaly. It's a microcosm. The agent fee, that's illegal but universal. The landlord who retaliates and faces no consequences. The means-tested subsidies that disqualify professionals who just got flattened by a move they didn't choose.
The numbers are only going to get worse. Housing costs keep rising. Rental protections aren't coming. There's no political constituency for them because the people who'd benefit are too exhausted to organize. So Daniel's situation today is going to be someone else's situation next July, and the July after that. The conversation has to shift from, how do I survive this system, to how do we change it?
That's the uncomfortable part. Individual resilience isn't going to fix the agent fee. It's not going to make landlords think twice before terminating leases over repair requests. Those are policy failures, and they need policy solutions. Actual enforcement of the agent fee ban. Just cause eviction protections. The stuff that exists in Germany and doesn't exist here.
Until that changes, the best we can offer is what we laid out today. Make the call. And give yourself permission to stop being the person who handles everything alone, because that person was never real. They were just someone the system was counting on to stay quiet.
If this episode was useful to you, share it with someone who's moving, or someone who's about to. And if you've got a weird prompt for us, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop.
This has been My Weird Prompts. We'll be here when you need us.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.